But first, Michel Norris, best known to public radio listeners as co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. In 2008, Norris co-moderated a series of award-winning conversations on race and politics. She meant to go on to write a book about this, but she ended up writing a much more personal story. It's called The Grace of Silence. As she told Anne Strainchamps, she wrote the memoir after she uncovered, quite by accident, that her family had a hidden racial past.
I started listening to hidden conversations all over the place, including in my own family. The more I learned about these secrets that my parents sat on because they didn't want to clutter our path, they didn't want to poison our American experience with the pain from their past, I realized that I just couldn't let go of what I was learning, and I changed course.
The big revelation was a secret your father had kept, not only from you and your sisters, but from your mother.
Imagine that you're up in years. You've lived a full life. You've watched your children grow and become productive adults. And imagine that at some point you realize that the man that you had been married to for several years, you'd raised children with, had kept a tremendous secret from you. That he was shot when he was a young man, when he returned to Birmingham, Alabama, after his service in the military. And he never talked about it. Never told me, never told my mom. And imagine if you're that woman and you hear from that from your nosy daughter, which is exactly what happened.
What happened? How did you uncover this story in the first place?
Well, I learned about it from an uncle who just blurted it out one day while we were having breakfast. He was upset about young people not voting and that they took things for granted and they didn't realize that, you know, all the sacrifices that had been made years ahead of them. And he just said, well, you know, your father was shot. And he regretted saying it immediately.
Did he try to back
off? Well, he sort of pushed his food away and said, okay, you know, I'll tell you what I know, which was not much. So then I have to go through this sort of anthropological process to go to relatives who I thought may have known. And, you know, calling up people who I knew had this secret and trying to figure out how do I ask these elders to share this with me because they kept it a secret for a reason. Are they trying to honor my father's secret? And I would get one of two reactions. They would either say, oh, God, you know, Mickey, now you know, because my family calls me Mickey. Mm-hmm. And they would have the sense of, you know, heavy-hearted regret. Well, okay, you found out. Cat's out of the bag now. Or they would be really angry at me, and they would treat me like I was an 8-year-old again, and I was asking for, you know, a piece of pie that they weren't ready to give up. I mean, they would just fuss at me like, I can't believe that you're calling me again. Ask me about this. I don't want to talk about this. Don't go looking for this stuff. And, of course, I couldn't. The daughter in me couldn't let it go. The journalist in me couldn't let it go. I felt this magnetic pull. And I just had to keep knocking and knocking and knocking on doors until I finally got people to talk to me about it. And then I realized I had to go to Alabama because that's really where the keys to the story were. And in that sense, I got lucky because I found documentation.
But it's like pulling on a ball of yarn.
Yeah.
You know? You just kept pulling and pulling. But clearly, it was a tremendous shock to you.
It was hard for me to swallow this, in part because of the man I knew. My father was a postal worker who raised his kids on the south side of Minneapolis. He was a by-the-book guy. He was very gentle and very kind, you know, had this sort of quiet wisdom about him. And he was very optimistic, and people liked to be in his orbit because of that.
So this really doesn't fit with the picture of a young man who was shot by a white
police
officer.
And it wasn't just that the picture of him being shot. It was what led up to the shooting. My dad returned to Birmingham at a period where the city was full of Black veterans who were coming back, and they came back as changed men, and they were met with disappointment and rejection time and time again. And my father, what surprised me so much, given what I knew about him, is that he was on that February evening in 1946 trying to enter a public building, and a policeman tried to stop him, and he stood up to the policeman. He confronted the policeman, which is something I just could not imagine. This is a guy who would, like, fuss at us if we jaywalked. He stood up to this police officer, and a scuffle ensued, and the police officer's gun went off, and that's when he was, the bullet grazed the side of his leg.
I mean, put that in some context. What does that mean for a young Black man to stand up to a police officer?
In the first 6 weeks of 1946, half a dozen returning Black veterans were killed by police officers in and around Birmingham. One of them was shot because there was a colored-only sign, and he said, I'm wearing a U.S. military uniform. I don't need to honor that sign. I'm going to move it. And in that case, a scuffle ensued, and he was shot in the head. His name was Timothy Hood. He died. There were cases where they were trying to vote, and if they knew that they were trying to vote, meaning the authorities, they might be visited in the dark of night. I mean, it was it, throughout the year 1946, this was not limited to Birmingham. Across the country, black veterans were beaten and burned and lynched, castrated, maimed. It was the blinding of a black veteran 3 hours after he was honorably discharged from the Army that so troubled Harry Truman that he appointed the commission that led to the full integration of the armed services. And I tried to talk to veterans who were returning to America at that time to understand what life was like for them. And not all of them that I talked to faced violence, but they did face a certain degree of marginalization when they returned. And they certainly were marginalized in the military because of the strict codes of segregation. And what they describe is this moment where they just decide that their manhood is more important than the strictures that have been forced down their throat all their lives.
And they had lived in the military with a different code and a different sense of who they were and how much respect they were due. And they're supposed to put that down when they come home?
Mm-hmm. So many of them painted a picture that began to make sense to me when I looked at my dad's life. If you had that experience, it would be easy to live the rest of your life as a malcontent, to speak out and sort of live on the fringe of life and just say, forget it. I'm not going to play by anybody's rules anymore. Instead, they took a different course. These men are almost like a social cohort. They tended to follow a very similar path. They decided collectively to live these lives of utter rectitude. I mean, they went the other way. Instead of like saying, I'm not going to follow anybody's rules, they followed the rules to the letter. They dressed impeccably. They kept their homes just so. Their cars were always, you know, you could see yourself in the chrome. They made sure that no one could ever complain about them at work.
They became model minorities.
They became model minorities, and they tried to raise model minorities. And they put all their ambitions in their kids and in this belief that they could prove to America that they belonged and that they were worthy of respect. They decided not to pass on their anger because they didn't manifest that anger, but I have to believe that it was there.
Burdens like that can also be inherited. Is there a feeling that you have to prove something to make up for your parents' pain?
Well, I feel that all the time. I feel like I have to prove something to the world in small ways. I mean, that was drummed into me so much, you know, that based on your achievements, the door's going to open a little bit wider for someone who comes behind you. Or maybe that door won't open at all if you don't go out there and rock the world. I mean, they wouldn't use that terminology, but it was always there. I felt that all the time.
Do you think that?
Today, and I'm not going to lie to you, I really do. I feel that sometimes when I sit in front of the microphone that I may help some other person of color, some other woman, someone else who, you know, doesn't come from an Ivy League school, you know, who hails from the Midwest, as I do, an opportunity to get in the door and make their own way. That's something that is so deeply ingrained in my DNA that you know, society might change, the opportunities might open, you know, for other people a little bit, you know, more broadly, but that is always there. And I don't know that it's a wound. I choose not to see it as a wound. It just is.
What about the long-term impact of stories like this? You track down some older people who were living in Birmingham mm-hmm. at the time, 1946, and I'm thinking about a conversation you had with a woman named Julie Beaton.
Julia's older brother, John, was with Dad the night he was shot. And she carried so much anger with her. I mean, more anger than I have ever heard expressed by any member of my family. And she told me things I didn't know. She told me stories about my grandparents coming home from a church revival dressed in all white, and a car full of kids, white kids, came careening down the street, and they threw rotten tomatoes at them while they were wearing all white clothing. And how, you know, she watched this happen as a kid, and she's so angry about it to this day. She's angry about having to go to the movies and paying for a ticket and then going outside around to the fire escape in the back and walking up to the balcony, you know, to watch a film. She's angry about having to sit in a certain part of the bus or having to step off the sidewalk. I mean, all these things still live inside her. And she talked about, you know, how she doesn't trust white Americans.
Yeah, and she said her grandsons hate white Americans.
Yeah, she did. She did. And I called her back and I said, no, you sure? I know you said this and you know you said this, but this is going to be in print. Are you okay with this? And she said, you know, people need to understand what segregation did to some of us. And I decided to include that in the book for just that reason. You know, anger wasn't manifest in my family in quite that way. That was not the message that I got at my home. And I thought it was important to include it to show the contrast between her experiences and my family's, but also to include it because we talk so much about this honest conversation about race in this country. And if we truly want to have an honest conversation, those are the kinds of things that you might hear.
I was going to ask, is this the kind of conversation about race that you think we need to have?
I don't know if it's the kind that we need to have, but I don't know. I know it's the kind that we might not be able to avoid if we really want to be honest about this. And it's really complicated because imagine if she said that in a studio like this in front of a microphone, how people would react to something like that. Imagine if she said that in the course of a cable television program, your eyes are widening now. I mean, imagine that. It would be blown up and probably repeated because, ooh, this is what happens when people try to talk about race. What I learned in the experience of doing these conversations and what I learned in the course of working on this book is that the conversations can be painful and yet still productive if they are in safe spaces. But the other reason that I thought this was important is because of the message that she's passed on to her children. And, you know, when we think about race relations in America and we think about the hill we still have to climb, we often think about it in terms of white attitudes about Black America, that white America still looks through sort of a shaded lens at Black America. But what we don't consider all the time is the message that Black Americans pass on to their own kids, too, that their attitudes, that there's a healthy amount of distrust on both sides. And that's a painful but important part of that equation.
Michelle Norris is co-host of NPR's All Things Considered. She's won many awards for her work in journalism, including being named Journalist of the Year in 2009 by the National Association of Black Journalists. Her book is called The Grace of Silence. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps.